No, I'm not. We made an agreement. We stood around Mother Abigail's deathbed and entered into it. It almost certainly meant our deaths, and we knew it. We understood the agreement. Now we're going to live up to it. Well, I want to, for Christ's sake. I told you, we get a station wagon, put him in the back, and go on.
We're supposed to walk, Ralph said. He pointed at Stu. He can't walk.
Right, fine, he's got a broken leg. What do you propose we do? Shoot him like a horse?
Larry, Stu said.
Glenn grabbed Larry's shirt and yanked him toward him.
Who are you trying to save?
His voice was cold and stern.
Stu or yourself?
Larry looked at him, mouth working.
It's very simple, Glenn said. We can't stay, and he can't go.
I refuse to accept that, Larry whispered. His face was dead pale.
It's a test, Ralph said suddenly. That's what it is.
A sanity test, maybe, Larry said.
Vote, Stu said from the ground. I vote you go on.
Me too, Ralph said.
Stu, I'm sorry, but if God's going to watch out for us, maybe he'll watch out for you too.
I won't do it, Larry said.
It's not Stu you're thinking of, Glenn said. You're trying to save something in yourself, I think. But this time it's right to go on, Larry. We have to.
Larry rubbed his mouth slowly with the back of his hand.
Let's stay here tonight, he said. Let's think this thing out.
No, Stu said.
Ralph nodded. A look passed between him and Glenn, and then Glenn fished the bottle of arthritis pills out of his pocket and put it in Stu's hand.
These are morphine-based, he said. More than three or four would probably be fatal.
His eyes locked with Stu's.
Do you understand, East Texas?
Yeah, I get you.
What are you talking about? Larry asked shrilly. Just what the hell are you...
Don't you know? Ralph said, with such utter contempt that for a moment Larry was silenced.
Then it all rushed before him again with the nightmare speed of strangers' faces as you ride the whip at the carnival. Pills, uppers, downers, cruisers. Rita, turning her over in her sleeping bag and seeing that she was dead and stiff, green puke coming out of her mouth like a rancid party favor.
No!
He yelled, and tried to snatch the bottle from Stu's hand. Ralph grabbed him by the shoulders. Larry struggled.
Let him go, Stu said. I want to talk to him.
Ralph still held on, looking at Stu uncertainly.
No, go on, let him go.
Ralph let go, but looked ready to spring again. Stu said,
Come here, Larry. Hunker down.
Larry came over and hunkered by Stu. He looked miserably into Stu's face.
It's not right, man. When somebody falls down and breaks his leg, you can't just walk off and let them die. Don't you know that? Hey, man.
He touched Stu's face.
Please, think.
Stu took Larry's hand and held it.
Do you think I'm crazy?
No, but...
And do you think that people who are in their right minds have the right to decide for themselves what they want to do?
Oh, man, Larry said, and started to cry.
Larry, you're not in this. I want you to go on. If you get out of Vegas, come back this way. Maybe God will send a raven to feed me, you don't know. I once read in the funny pages that a man can go 70 days without food if he's got water.
It's going to be winter before that here. You'll be dead in 3 days even if you don't use the pills.
That ain't up to you. You ain't in this part of it.
Don't send me away, Stu.
Stu said grimly,
I'm sending you.
This sucks, Larry said, and got to his feet.
What's Fran going to say to us when she finds out we left you for the gophers and the buzzards?
She's not going to say anything if you don't get over there and fix his clock. Neither is Lucy, or any of the others.
Larry said, Okay, we'll go. But tomorrow... We'll camp here tonight, and maybe we'll have a dream, something...
No dreams, Stu said gently. No signs. It doesn't work like that. You'd stay one night, and there'd be nothing, and then you'd want to stay another night,
And another night? You got to go right now.
Larry walked away from them, head down, and stood with his back turned. All right, he said at last, in a voice almost too low to hear. We'll do it your way. God help our souls. Ralph came over to Stu and knelt down.
Can we get you anything, Stu?
Stu smiled.
Yeah, all those books about that Kent family. I always meant to read them. Now it looks like I got the chance.
Ralph grinned crookedly. Sorry, Stu. Looks like I'm tapped. Stu squeezed his arm and Ralph went away.
Glenn came over. He had also been crying, and when he sat down by Stu, he started leaking again.
Come on, you baby, Stu said. I'll be okay.
Larry's right. This is bad. Like something you do to a horse.
You know it has to be done.
I guess I do, but who really knows? How's that leg?
No pain at all right now.
Okay, you got the pills.
Glenn swiped his arm across his eyes.
Goodbye, East Texas. It's been pretty goddamn good to know you.
Stu turned his head aside. Don't say goodbye, Glenn. Make it so long, that's better luck. You'll probably get halfway up that friggin' bank and fall down here and we can spend the winter playing cribbage.
It's not so long, Glenn said. I feel that, don't you?
And because he did, Stu turned his face back to look at Glenn.
Yeah, I do, he said, and then smiled a little. But I will fear no evil, right?
Right, Glenn said. His voice had dropped to a husky whisper.
Pull the plug if you have to, Stuart. Don't screw around.
Nope.
Goodbye, then.
Goodbye, Glenn. The three of them drew together on the west side of the gully, and after a look back over his shoulder, Glenn started to go up. Stu followed his progress up the side with growing alarm. He was moving casually, almost carelessly, hardly even glancing at his footing. The ground crumbled away beneath him once, then twice. Both times he grabbed nonchalantly for a handhold, and both times one just happened to be there. When he reached the top, Stu released his pent-up breath in a long, harsh sigh. Ralph went next, and when he reached the top, Stu called Larry over one last time. He looked up into Larry's face and reflected that, in a way, it was something like Harold's. Remarkably still, the eyes watchful and a little wary. A face that gave away nothing but what it wanted to give away.
You're in charge now, Stu said. Can you handle it?
I don't know. I'll try.
His men are going to grab you.
Yeah, I figure they will. They'll either grab us or shoot us from ambush like we were dogs.
No, I think they'll grab you and take you to him. It'll happen in the next few days, I think.
When you get to Vegas, keep your eyes open. Wait. It'll come.
What, Stu? What'll come?
I don't know. Whatever we were sent for. Be ready. Know it when it comes.
We'll be back for you if we can. You know it.
Yeah, okay.
Larry went up the bank quickly and joined the other two. They stood and waved down. Stu raised his hand in return. They left. And none of them ever saw Stu Redman again. Chapter 63. The three of them camped 16 miles west of the place where they had left Stu. They had come to another washout, this one minor. The real reason they had made such poor mileage was because some of the heart seemed to have gone out of them. Their feet seemed to weigh more. There was little conversation. They camped at dark and built a scrub fire. There was water, but no food. Glenn tamped the last of his tobacco into his pipe and wondered suddenly if Stu had any cigarettes. The thought spoiled his own taste for tobacco, and he knocked his pipe out on a rock, absently kicking away the last of his Borkum riff. When an owl hooted somewhere out in the darkness a few minutes later, he looked around.
"Say, where's Kojak?" he asked.
"Now that's kind of funny, ain't it?" Ralph said. "I can't remember seeing him the last couple hours at all."
Glenn got to his feet.
"Kojak!" he yelled. "Hey, Kojak! Kojak!"
His voice echoed lonesomely away into the wastes. There was no answering bark. He sat down again, overcome with gloom. A soft sighing noise escaped him. Kojak had followed him almost all the way across the continent. Now he was gone. It was like a terrible omen.
"You suppose something got him?" Ralph asked softly.
Larry said in a quiet, thoughtful voice, "Maybe he stayed with Stu."
Glenn looked up, startled.
"Maybe," he said, considering it.
"Maybe that's what happened."
The fire made a popping sound, sending a column of sparks up into the darkness to whirl in brief brightness, and then to wink out.
When Stu saw the dark shape come slinking down the gully toward him, he pulled himself up against the nearby boulder, legs sticking out stiffly in front of him, and found a good-sized stone with one numb hand. He was chilled to the bone. Larry had been right. 2 or 3 days of lying around in these temperatures was going to kill him quite efficiently. Except now it looked like whatever this was would get him first. Kojak had remained with him until sunset, and then had left him, scrambling easily out of the gully. Stu had not called him back. The dog would find his way back to Glenn and go on with them. Perhaps he had his own part to play. But now he wished that Kojak had stayed a little longer. The pills were one thing, but he had no wish to be ripped to pieces by one of the dark man's wolves. He gripped the rock harder, and the dark shape paused about 20 yards up the cut. Then it started coming again, a blacker shadow in the night.
"Come on, then," Stu said hoarsely.
The black shadow wagged its tail and came.
"Kojak?"
It was. And there was something in his mouth, something he dropped at Stu's feet. He sat down, tail thumping, waiting to be complimented.
"Good dog," Stu said in amazement. "Good dog."
Kojak had brought him a rabbit. Stu pulled out his pocket knife, opened it, and disemboweled the rabbit in 3 quick movements. He picked up the steaming guts and tossed them to Kojak.
"Want these?"
Kojak did. Stu skinned the rabbit. The thought of eating it raw didn't do much for his stomach.
"Wood," he said to Kojak without much hope.
There were scattered branches and hunks of tree all along the banks of the gully, dropped by the flash flood, but nothing within reach. Kojak wagged his tail and didn't move.
Fetch?
But Kojak was gone. He whirled, streaked to the east side of the gully, and ran back with a large piece of deadwood in his jaws. He dropped it beside Stu and barked. His tail wagged rapidly.
"Good dog," Stu said again. "I'll be a son of a bitch. Fetch, Kojak."
Barking with joy, Kojak went again. In 20 minutes he had brought back enough wood for a large fire. Stu carefully stripped enough splinters to make kindling. He checked the match situation and saw that he had 1.5 books. He got the kindling going on the 2nd match and fed the fire carefully. Soon there was a respectable blaze going, and Stu got as close to it as he could, sitting in his sleeping bag. Kojak lay down on the far side of the fire with his nose on his paws. When the fire had burned down a little, Stu spitted the rabbit and cooked it. The smell was soon strong enough and savory enough to have his stomach rumbling. Kojak came to attention.
"Half for you and half for me, big guy, okay?"
15 minutes later, he pulled the rabbit off the fire and managed to rip it in half without burning his fingers too badly. The meat was burned in places, half raw in others, and it tasted wonderful. He and Kojak gulped it down, and as they were finishing, a bone-chilling howl drifted down the wash.
"Christ," Stu said around a mouthful of rabbit.
Kojak was on his feet, hackles up, growling. He advanced stiff-legged around the fire and growled again. Whatever had howled fell silent. Stu lay down, the hand-sized rock nearby. His thoughts turned to Fran, and he turned them away just as quickly. That hurt too much, full belly or not. "But I won't sleep," he thought, "not for a long time." But he did sleep, with the help of one of Glenn's pills. And when the coals of the fire had burned down to embers, Kojak came over and slept next to him, giving Stu his heat. And that was how, on the 1st night after the party was broken, Stu ate when the others went hungry,
and slept easy while their sleep was broken by bad dreams and an uneasy feeling of rapidly approaching doom. On the 24th, Larry Underwood's group of three pilgrims camped northeast of the San Rafael Knob. That night, the temperature slid down into the mid-20s, and they built a large fire and slept close by it. Kojak had not rejoined them.
"What do you think Stu's doing tonight?" Ralph asked Larry.
"Dying," Larry said shortly, and was sorry when he saw the wince of pain on Ralph's homely, honest face. But he didn't know how to redeem what he had said. And after all, it was almost surely true. He lay down again, feeling strangely certain that it was tomorrow. Whatever they were coming to, they were almost there. But they saw no one on the 25th. The three of them walked stolidly along under bright blue skies, and they saw birds and beasts in plenty, but no people.
"It's amazing how rapidly the wildlife is coming back," Glenn said. "I knew it would be a fairly rapid process, and of course the winter is going to prune it back some, but this is still amazing. It's only been about 100 days since the first outbreaks."
"Yeah, but there's no dogs or horses," Ralph said. "That just doesn't seem right, you know it. They invented a bug that killed pretty near all the people, but that wasn't enough. It had to take out his two favorite animals, too. It took man and man's best friends."
"And left the cats," Larry said morosely.
Ralph brightened.
"Well, there's Kojak."
"There was Kojak."
That killed the conversation. The buttes frowned down at them, hiding places for dozens of men with rifles and scopes. Larry's premonition that it was today hadn't left him. Each time they topped a rise, he expected to see the road blocked below them. And each time it wasn't, he thought about ambush. Then it was nearly dark and time to look for a place to camp. They came to the top of one final rise, and Larry thought, "Now, they'll be right down there." But there was no one. They camped near a green reflectorized sign that said, "Las Vegas 260. They had eaten comparatively well that day, taco chips, soda, and two Slim Jims that they shared out equally. "Tomorrow," Larry thought again, and slept. That night he dreamed that he and Barry Grieg and the tattered remnants were playing at Madison Square Garden. It was their big chance. They were opening for some supergroup that was named after a city, Boston or maybe Chicago. And all the microphone stands were at least 9 feet tall, and he began to stumble from one to the other in an increasing panic as the audience began to clap rhythmically and call for "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?" He looked down in the first row and felt a slapping dash of cold ice water fear. Charles Manson was there, the X on his forehead healed to a white, twisted scar, clapping and chanting. And Richard Speck was there, looking up at Larry with cocky, impudent eyes, an unfiltered cigarette jittering between his lips. They were flanking the dark man. Flag was leading the chant. "Tomorrow," Larry thought again. Stumbling from one too-tall mic to the next under the hot dream lights of Madison Square Garden. "I'll see you tomorrow." But it was not the next day, or the day after that. On the evening of September 27th, they camped in the town of Fremont Junction, and there was plenty to eat. "I keep expecting it to be over," Larry told Glenn that evening. "And every day that it's not, it gets worse." Glenn nodded. "Me too. It would be funny if he was just a mirage, wouldn't it? Nothing but a bad dream in our collective consciousness." Larry looked at him with momentary, surprised consideration. Then he shook his head slowly. "No, I don't think it's just a dream." Glenn smiled. "Nor do I, young man. Nor do I." They made contact the following day. At just past 10 in the morning, they topped a rise, and below them, and to the west, 5 miles away, two cars were parked, nose to nose, blocking the highway. "Accident?" Glenn asked. Ralph was shading his eyes. "I don't think so. Not parked that way."
"His men," Larry said.
"Yeah, I think so," Ralph agreed. "What do we do now, Larry?" Larry took his bandana out of his back pocket and wiped his face with it. Today, either summer had come back or they were starting to feel the southwestern desert. The temperature was in the low 80s. But it's a dry heat, he thought calmly. I'm only sweating a little, just a little. He stuffed the bandana back into his pocket. Now that it was actually on, he felt all right. We go down and see what happens, right, Glenn? You're the boss. They started to walk again. Half an hour brought them close enough to see that the nose-to-nose cars had once belonged to the Utah State Patrol. There were several armed men waiting for them. Are they going to shoot us? Ralph asked conversationally. I don't know, Larry said. Because some of those rifles are Wowzers, scope-equipped. I can see the sun ticking off the lenses. If they want to knock us down, we'll be in range any time. They kept walking. The men at the roadblock split into two groups, about 5 men in front, guns aimed at the party of 3 walking toward them, and 3 more crouched behind the cars. 8 of them, Larry? Glenn asked. I make it 8, yeah. How are you doing, anyhow? I'm okay, Glenn said. Ralph? Just as long as we know what to do when the time comes, Ralph said. That's all I want. Larry gripped his hand for a moment and squeezed it. Then he took Glenn's hand and did likewise. They were less than a mile from the cruisers now. They're not going to shoot us outright, Ralph said. They would have done it already. Now they could discern faces, and Larry searched them curiously. One was heavily bearded. Another was young, but mostly bald. Must have been a bummer for him to start losing his hair while he was still in school, Larry thought. Another was wearing a bright yellow tank top with a picture of a grinning camel on it, and below the camel the word Super Hump in scrawled old-fashioned letters. Another of them had the look of an accountant. He was fiddling with a .357 Magnum, and he looked 3 times as nervous as Larry felt. He looked like a man who was going to blow off one of his own feet if he didn't settle down. They don't look no different from our guys, Ralph said. Sure they do, Glenn answered. They're all packing guns. They approached to within 20 feet of the police cars blocking the road. Larry stopped, and the others stopped with him. There was a dead moment of silence as flagsmen and Larry's small band of pilgrims looked each other over. Then Larry Underwood said mildly, Hi. The little man who looked like a CPA stepped forward. He was still twiddling with the Magnum. Are you Glendon Bateman, Lawson Underwood, Stuart Redman, and Ralph Brentner? Say, you dummy, Ralph said. Can't you count? Someone snickered. The CPA type flushed. Who's missing? Larry said, Stu met with an accident on the way here, and I believe you're going to have one yourself if you don't stop fooling with that gun. There were more snickers. The CPA managed to tuck the pistol into the waistband of his gray slacks, which made him look more ridiculous than ever. A Walter Mitty outlaw daydream. My name is Paul Burleson, he said, and by virtue of the power vested in me, I arrest you and order you to come with me. In whose name? Glenn said immediately. Burleson looked at him with contempt, but the contempt was mixed with something else. You know who I speak for. Then say it. But Burleson was silent. Are you afraid? Glenn asked him. He looked at all 8 of them. Are you so afraid of him you don't dare speak his name? Very well, I'll say it for you. His name is Randall Flagg, also known as the Dark Man, also known as the Walkin' Dude. Don't some of you call him that? His voice had climbed to the high, clear octaves of fury. Some of the men looked uneasily at each other, and Burleson fell back a step. Call him Beelzebub, because that's his name, too. Call him Nyarlathotep and Ahaz and Astaroth. Call him Rayella and Seti and Anubis. His name is Legion, and he's an apostate of hell, and you men kiss his ass. His voice dropped to a conversational pitch again. He smiled disarmingly. Just thought we ought to have that out front. Grab them, Burleson said. Grab them all and shoot the first one that moves. For one strange second, no one moved at all, and Larry thought, They're not going to do it. They're as afraid of us as we are of them. More afraid.
even though they have the guns.
He looked at Burleson and said, "Who are you kidding, you little douchebag? We want to go, that's why we came."
Then they moved, almost as though it was Larry who had ordered them. He and Ralph were bundled into the back of one cruiser, Glenn into the back of the other. They were behind a steel mesh grill. There were no inside door handles.
"We're arrested," Larry thought. He found that the idea amused him.
Four men smashed into the front seat. The cruiser backed up, turned around, and began to head west. Ralph sighed.
"Scared?" Larry asked him in a low voice.
"I'll be frigged if I know. It feels so good to be off my dogs, I can't tell."
One of the men in front said, "The old man with the big mouth, he in charge?"
"No, I am."
"What's your name?"
"Larry Underwood. This is Ralph Brentner. The other guy's Glenn Bateman."
He looked out the back window. The other cruiser was behind them.
"What happened to the other guy?"
"He broke his leg. We had to leave him."
"Tough go, all right. I'm Barry Dorgan, Vegas Security."
Larry felt an absurd response, "Pleased to meet you," rise to his lips, and had to smile a little.
"How long a drive is it to Las Vegas?"
"Well, we can't whistle along too fast because of the stalls in the road. We're clearing them out from the city, but it's slow going. We'll be there in about 5 hours.
"Isn't that something?" Ralph said, shaking his head. "We've been on the road 3 weeks, and just about 5 hours in a car takes you there."
Dorgan squirmed around until he could look at them.
"I don't understand why you were walking. For that matter, I don't understand why you came at all. You must have known it would end like this."
"We were sent," Larry said. "To kill Flag, I think."
"Not much chance of that, buddy. You and your friends are going right into the Las Vegas County Jail. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. He's got a special interest in you. He knew you were coming."
He paused.
"You just want to hope he makes it quick for you. But I don't think he will. He hasn't been in a very good mood lately."
"Why not?" Larry asked.
But Dorgan seemed to feel he had said enough. Too much, maybe. He turned around without answering, and Larry and Ralph watched the desert flow by. In just 3 weeks, speed had become a novelty all over again.
It actually took them 6 hours to reach Vegas. It lay in the middle of the desert like some improbable gem. There were a lot of people on the streets. The workday was over, and people were enjoying the early evening cool on lawns and benches and at bus stops, or sitting in the doorways of defunct wedding chapels and hock shops. They rubbernecked the Utah SP cars as they went by, and then went back to whatever they'd been talking about.
Larry was looking around thoughtfully. The electricity was on, the streets were cleared, and the rubble of looting was gone.
"Glenn was right," he said. "He's got the trains running on time. But still, I wonder if this is any way to run a railroad."
"Your people all look like they've got a nervous complaint, Dorgan."
Dorgan didn't reply. They arrived at the county jail and drove around to the rear. The two police cars parked in a cement courtyard. When Larry got out, wincing at the stiffness that had settled into his muscles, he saw that Dorgan had two sets of handcuffs.
"Hey, come on," he said, "really?"
"Sorry, his orders."
Ralph said, "I ain't never been handcuffed in my life. I was picked up and throwed in the drunk tank a couple of times before I was married, but never was I cuffed."
Ralph was speaking slowly, his Oklahoma accent becoming more pronounced, and Larry realized he was totally furious.
"I have my orders," Dorgan said. "Don't make it tougher than it is."
"Your orders," Ralph said. "I know who gives your orders. You murdered my friend Nick. What are you doing hooked up with that hellhound? You seem like a nice enough fellow when you're by yourself."
He was looking at Dorgan with such an expression of angry interrogation that Dorgan shook his head and looked away.
"This is my job," he said, "and I have no intention of playing 20 questions with you. Put your wrists out or I'll have somebody hold them out."
Larry put his hands out and Dorgan cuffed him.
"What were you?" Larry asked curiously. "Before?"
"Santa Monica police. Detective Second.
And you're with him.
It's... Forgive me for saying so, but it's really sort of funny. Glenn Bateman was pushed over to join them.
What are you shoving him around for? Dorgan asked angrily.
If you had to listen to 6 hours of this guy's bullshit, you'd do some pushing too, one of them said.
Keep your hands to yourself.
He looked at Larry. Why is it funny that I should be with him? I was a cop for 10 years before Captain Trips. I saw what happens when guys like you are in charge, you see.
Young man, Glenn said mildly, your experiences with a few battered babies and drug abusers does not justify your embrace of a monster.
Get them out of here, Dorgan said evenly. Separate cells, separate wings.
I don't think you'll be able to live with your choice, young man, Glenn said. There doesn't seem to be quite enough Nazi in you.
This time, Dorgan pushed Glenn himself. Larry was separated from the other two and taken down an empty corridor graced with signs reading, No spitting, this way to showers and delousing, and one that read, You are not a guest.
I wouldn't mind a shower, he said.
Maybe, Dorgan said, we'll see.
See what?
How cooperative you can be.
Dorgan opened a cell at the end of the corridor and ushered Larry in.
How about the bracelets? Larry asked him, holding them out.
Sure.
Dorgan unlocked them and took them off.
Better?
Much.
Still want that shower?
Yeah.
More than that, Larry didn't want to be left alone. Alone, the fear would start to come back into him.
Dorgan produced a small notebook.
How many are you in the zone?
6,000, Larry said. We all play bingo every Thursday night, and the prize in the coverall game is a 20-pound turkey.
Do you want that shower or not?
I want it.
But no longer thought he was going to get it.
How many of you over there?
25,000, but 4,000 are under 12 and get in free at the drive-in. Economically speaking, it's a bummer.
Dorgan snapped his notebook shut and looked at him.
I can't, man, Larry said.
Dorgan shook his head.
Why are you guys here? What good do you think it's going to do you? He's going to kill you dead as dog shit tomorrow or the next day. And if he wants you to talk, you will. If he wants you to tap dance and jerk off at the same time, you'll do that too. You must be crazy.
We were told to come by the old woman, Mother Abigail. Probably you dreamed about her.
Dorgan shook his head, but suddenly his eyes wouldn't meet Larry's.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Then let's leave it at that.
Sure you don't want to talk to me? Get that shower?
Larry laughed.
I don't work that cheap.
Any way you want it, Dorgan said.
He walked back down the hallway under the mesh-enclosed lights. At the far end, he stepped past a steel-barred gate that rolled shut behind him with a hollow crash. Larry looked around. Like Ralph, he had been in jail on a couple of occasions, public intoxication once, possession of an ounce of marijuana on another. Flaming youth.
It's not the Ritz, he muttered.
The mattress on the bunk looked decidedly moldy, and he wondered if someone had died on it back in June or early July. The toilet worked, but filled with rusty water the first time he flushed it. Someone had left a paperback Western. Larry picked it up and then put it down again. He sat on the bunk and listened to the silence. He had always hated to be alone. But in a way, he always had been. Until he had arrived in the free zone. And now it wasn't so bad as he had been afraid it would be. Bad enough, but he could cope.
He's going to kill you dead as dog shit tomorrow or the next day.
Except Larry didn't believe it. It just wasn't going to happen that way.
I will fear no evil, he said into the dead silence of the cell block wing, and he liked the way it sounded.
He said it again.
He lay down, and the thought occurred that he had finally made it most of the way back to the West Coast. But the trip had been longer and stranger than anyone ever could have imagined. And the trip wasn't quite over yet.
I will fear no evil, he said again. He fell asleep, his face calm, and he slept in dreamless peace. At 10 o'clock the next day, 24 hours after they had first seen the roadblock in the distance, Randall Flagg and Lloyd Henreid came to see Glenn Bateman. He was sitting cross-legged on the floor of his cell. He had found a piece of charcoal under his bunk and had just finished writing this legend on the wall amid the intaglio of male and female genitals, names, phone numbers, and obscene little poems. I am not the potter, nor the potter's wheel, but the potter's clay. Is not the value of the shape attained as dependent upon the intrinsic worth of the clay as upon the wheel and the master's skill? Glenn was admiring this proverb, or was it an aphorism, when the temperature in the deserted cell block suddenly seemed to drop 10 degrees. The door at the end of the corridor rumbled open. The saliva in Glenn's mouth was suddenly all gone, and the charcoal snapped between his fingers. Boot heels clocked up the hallway toward him. Other footfalls, smaller and insignificant, pattered along in counterpoint, trying to keep up. Why, it's him. I'm going to see his face. Suddenly, his arthritis was worse. Terrible, in fact. It seemed that his bones had suddenly been hollowed out and filled with ground glass. And still, he turned with an interested, expectant smile on his face as the boot heel stopped in front of his cell. "Well, there you are," Glenn said. "And you're not half the boogeyman we thought you must be." Standing on the other side of the bars were two men. Flagg was on Glenn's right. He was wearing blue jeans and a white silk shirt that gleamed mellowly in the dim lights. He was grinning in at Glenn. Beside him was a shorter man who was not smiling at all. He had an undershot chin and eyes that seemed too big for his face. His complexion was one that the desert climate was never going to be kind to. He had burned, peeled, and burned again. Around his neck he wore a black stone flawed with red. "I'd like you to meet my associate," Flagg said with a giggle. "Lloyd Henreid, meet Glenn Bateman, sociologist, Free Zone committee member, and single existing member of the Free Zone think tank, now that Nick Andros is dead." "Meet you," Lloyd mumbled. "How's your arthritis, Glenn?" Flagg asked. His tone was commiserating, but his eyes sparkled with high glee and secret knowledge. Glenn opened and closed his hands rapidly, smiling back at Flagg. No one would ever know what an effort it took to maintain that gentle smile. The intrinsic worth of the clay. "Fine," he said. "Much better for sleeping indoors, thank you." Flagg's smile faltered a bit. Glenn caught just a glimpse of narrow surprise and anger. Of fear? "I've decided to let you go," he said briskly. His smile sprang forth again, radiant and vulpine. Lloyd uttered a gasp of surprise, and Flagg turned to him. "Haven't we, Lloyd?"
Sure, Lloyd said. "Sure we have."
"Well, fine," Glenn said easily. He could feel the arthritis sinking deeper and deeper into his joints, numbing them like ice, swelling them like fire. "You'll be given a small motorbike, and you may drive back at your leisure."
"Of course, I couldn't go without my friends."
"No, of course not. And all you have to do is ask. Get down on your knees and ask me." Glenn laughed heartily. He threw back his head and laughed long and hard. And as he laughed, the pain in his joints began to abate. He felt better, stronger, in control again.
"Oh, you're a card," he said. "I tell you what you do. Why don't you find a nice big sand pile, get yourself a hammer, and pound all that sand right up your ass."
Flagg's face grew dark. The smile slipped away. His eyes, previously as dark as the jetstone Lloyd wore, now seemed to gleam yellowly. He reached out his hand to the locking mechanism on the door and wrapped his fingers around it. There was an electric buzzing sound. Fire leaped out between his fingers, and there was a hot smell in the air. The lockbox fell to the floor, smoking and black. Lloyd Henreid cried out. The dark man grabbed the bars and threw the cell door back on its track.
"Stop laughing!"
Glenn laughed harder.
"Stop laughing at me!"
"You're nothing,"
Glenn said, wiping his streaming eyes and still chuckling.
"Oh, pardon me. It's just that we were all so frightened. We made such a business out of you. I'm laughing as much at our own foolishness as at your regrettable lack of substance."
"Shoot him, Lloyd." Flagg had turned to the other man. His face was working horribly. His hands were hooked into predator's claws.
"Oh, kill me yourself if you're going to kill me," Glenn said. "Surely you're capable. Touch me with your finger and stop my heart. Make the sign of the inverted cross and give me a massive brain embolism. Bring down the lightning from the overhead socket to cleave me in two. Oh, dear me.
Glenn collapsed onto the cell cot and rocked back and forth, consumed with delicious laughter.
"Shoot him!"
the dark man roared at Lloyd. Pale, shaking with fear, Lloyd fumbled the pistol out of his belt, almost dropped it, then tried to point it at Glenn. He had to use both hands. Glenn looked at Lloyd, still smiling. He might have been at a faculty cocktail party back in the brain ghetto at Woodsville, New Hampshire, recovering from a good joke, now ready to turn the conversation back into more serious channels of reflection.
"If you have to shoot somebody, Mr. Henry, shoot him."
"Do it now, Lloyd." Lloyd pulled the trigger. The gun went off with a tremendous crash in the enclosed space. The echoes bounced furiously back and forth. But the bullet only chipped concrete 2 inches from Glenn's right shoulder, ricocheted, struck something else, and whined off again.
"Can't you do anything?" Flagg roared. "Shoot him, you moron! Shoot him! He's standing right in front of you!"
"I'm trying."
Glenn's smile had not changed, and he had only flinched a little at the gunshot.
"I repeat, if you must shoot somebody, shoot him. He's really not human at all, you know. I once described him to a friend as the last magician of rational thought, Mr. Henry. That was more correct than I knew. But he's losing his magic now. It's slipping away from him, and he knows it. And you know it, too. Shoot him now and save us all God knows how much bloodshed and dying."
Flagg's face had grown very still. "Shoot one of us anyhow, Lloyd," he said. "I got you out of jail when you were dying of starvation. It's guys like this that you wanted to get back at. Little guys who talk big." Lloyd said, "Mister, you don't fool me. It's like Randy Flagg says."
"But he lies. You know he lies."
"He told me more of the truth than anyone else bothered to in my whole lousy life," Lloyd said, and shot Glenn 3 times. Glenn was driven backward, twisted and turned like a rag doll. Blood flew in the dim air. He struck the cot, bounced, and rolled onto the floor. He managed to get up on one elbow.
"It's all right, Mr. Henreid," he whispered. "You don't know any better.